to episode 160 of Fly Away, a weekly podcast from Outlander Travel about the thing we love most, travel. We're glad you're joining us this week. Our goal is to inform, educate, and inspire. We hope that tuning in for our weekly chats will help push you outside of your comfort zone and add some new experiences to your bucket list. We also welcome ideas for topics, so if there's something you'd like to hear more about, let us know. My name is Elizabeth, and this week I am joined by fellow Outlander travel agents Donna, Lindsay, Laura, Sandy, and tonight we also welcome back our very special guest, my sister, Linda. Yay! Linda's here. Actually, I'm with Linda, technically, but whatever. But we're going to talk tonight about Oman. It's a sultanate located on the southeastern coast of the Arabian Peninsula, mostly a gravel desert plain. There are two mountain ranges, the Al Hajar Mountains in the north and the Kara or Dhofar Mountains along the southeast coast. Oman was once covered by oceans long, long time ago, so there are fossilized plant life. There's fossilized plant life in the interior. Besides oil and gas reserves, tourism is one of the main industries. It is a land of rich history dating back over 5,000 years. It is still steeped in ancient traditions and heritage, and it is a destination that is definitely much overlooked by the traditional traveler. Linda just returned from a 10-day vacation to this interesting country, and we are so excited to have her with us tonight to talk about her experience. So let's get started. So I think the obvious question is, why go to Oman? What drew you to that?
Well, as you know, I tend to have a sense of wanting to see as many places on earth because I love experiencing different cultures. And this was an area that I hadn't been to before. I've been to Dubai, but not any of the surrounding areas around that. And Oman in general is one of the more open and accessible places in the Arabian Peninsula, and also just has some incredible food and really amazing, wonderful, friendly, and warm people. It's a great place to see a variety of landscapes and a variety of history and culture, but all in an environment that's actually very easy to travel in.
What do you mean by open and accessible?
So the Sultan of Oman, who's been in his seat for almost 47 years now, has really dedicated his life and been very clear with the people of Oman that he wants it to be a very open and accepting country. So you see a lot of different cultures when you're in Oman, and it's a sort of an area that's very, very focused on welcoming all different types of people and making them feel comfortable as they come to visit and even work in Oman.
So is he focusing on tourism or is he focusing on business and industry or both?
Both, actually. But it's really more about just being welcoming to all different cultures. But work and industry is a lot of it. But a lot of that work and industry is tourism. As you mentioned, it's one of their main industries right now. And so they want to bring in a lot of different cultures and a lot of different people to kind of welcome the world to Oman.
So I was looking at the map and it's a small country, I would say maybe size of New Jersey, kind of. Is that?
It's a little bit bigger than that. So, for example, when we went to four different areas of Oman, to experience the different sort of cultures and landscapes. And we flew from Muscat which is at the north, to Salalah, which is in the south. And that was probably about a 2-hour flight, just from top to bottom. And then there was a lot of driving in between. So it's actually a bit larger than New Jersey, but it is still, fairly small for the region.
That's actually quite a bit larger. I mean,
yeah.
2 hours, that's more than Raleigh to New York. That's more like Raleigh to Maine almost, or Boston. Yeah.
So I'm curious, Linda, because it is a Muslim country, is it required that you have your head covered, and does it have those same side kind of rules that we hear about in the United States?
Yeah, so for everyday life and for going around as a tourist, you don't have to have your head covered, although you might want to because the sun is pretty intense there. But it's really more about when you're going into the mosques, you need to have your head, knees, and shoulders covered. Most of your arms should be covered as well. And then there's just different times in restaurants where they usually expect you to be a little bit more conservative. I've always taken the approach when I travel that I would rather be as respectful as possible to the culture of any country that I'm in. So I tend to wear like lighter weight, long sleeve, long pants, or a long skirt. in order just to sort of be safe, as far as making sure that people feel that I respect where I am and respect their culture, which is actually quite handy anyway, because the sun is quite intense. And so if you're wearing longer sleeves and stuff, you feel a little bit more protected from the sun. And then I just usually bring some scarves to put over my head, when I'm going into a mosque specifically. But the positive thing is, because they're very open and used to tourists, they'll always have scarves there at the ready. And so there'll be women and men sort of ready to help you dress to go into the mosque and make sure that you're covered appropriately and lend you whatever it is you need to be able to see the facility.
So whenever you go into the mosques, are you just looking at the architecture, or why do we visit mosques?
I guess it's a little bit similar to when you would visit a cathedral in Italy or anything like that. The architecture is actually quite stunning. So, for example, in Muscat, which was the first city and it's the capital city, there's the Sultan's Grand Mosque, which actually holds 20,000 worshippers on its grounds. And it's really a stunning piece of architecture and just an incredibly beautiful place. And it's known for several things, including having the largest chandelier in the world that hangs in the middle. And there's also this beautiful prayer carpet that was actually made in Iran and brought to Oman for this particular mosque that covers more than 4,300 square meters with one carpet. So it's a big rug. Yeah, it's a really big rug, but it's a really beautiful, beautiful, beautiful building. And there's just an amazing amount of detail and work. It's a limestone mosque. And so it's pretty breathtaking to see all of it in general, but then also just to learn a little bit about the culture and how they worship and what, you know, different types of Islam are.
So on that, you know, visiting different parts of Oman for different parts of culture, can you sort of talk about the route you took and why you chose the places that you chose, assuming you even chose them, or were they chosen?
Yeah,
for
well,
you?
It was, so it was a trip with three friends, you know, three women that went together. And so I can say that most of the planning was actually done by my friend Lauren and she did an amazing job. But it was really a concept of, okay, what are the different types of things that you want to see? So we started in Muscat, which is again the capital city. And most of what you're seeing there is, you know, there's a souk, which is their market. So you can do a little bit of shopping. They have both a regular souk and then a gold and silver souk if you want to buy some jewelry. The mosque is there, the palace is there, and so you're able to see what I would call more like city cultural sites. Then we actually went on to do some desert camping, which was really, really stunning, and that was in the Wahiba Sands, where you're actually kind of camping among the Bedouin people, which are more of the desert nomads that live in the desert, and they tend to raise racing camels and goats and such, which is really kind of cool. You're just wandering along and there's a, you know,
you camel get, runs
you,
by.
Yeah. You just get camels coming through your camp and they're really pretty cute. They're huge, but they're cute.
I'm picturing you loading up a camel with like tents and stuff.
I know. I'm also, you can tell we are quite different as sisters. So when you say camping, do you mean camping or do you mean glamping?
This one's more glamping. I mean, you can camp there, but I wouldn't recommend doing that unless you're a pretty experienced camper, because you are out in the middle of nowhere. Like, you're in the middle of dunes and, you know, you have to know how to drive in desert sands and stuff like that, which is quite challenging. But this is glamping. So someone else sets it up. There's a private chef. You've got tents that actually have full beds in them. It was quite lovely.
So maybe we're not so different after all.
Yeah. That being said, I think one of the best, one of the most beautiful places that we went was actually, was in the Jebel Akhdar Mountains, which is the highest peak in all of the mountains in Oman. And we stayed at the Alila Resort there, their hashtag is 15 degrees cooler because it's so high up in the mountains. It is actually a completely different climate. The area is called the Green Mountain and it's really lush and gorgeous. You have these beautiful views of, gorges and stuff like that. So that was really kind of the highlight of the trip as far as luxury and relaxing, and you can hike and mainly eat. There's a lot of eating in Oman.
We'll get to that. So 15 degrees cooler means it was how hot?
Well, actually, no, up there it was about 17 degrees Celsius, which is, you know, you're in the 70s at that point.
So really quite nice.
Yeah, really quite nice, which is in other parts of Oman on the trip, it would, you know, it was above 100 a lot of the times that we were traveling around.
So since you were doing lots of eating, what were you eating?
Oh, gosh, just about everything. So one of my favorite things that we had while we were in the Wahiba Sands, as we were doing the desert camping, we actually came out to go to what's called a wadi, which is kind of like an oasis. It's an area where there's a river running through and there's a bunch of green and everything lush in the middle of a pretty desert landscape, and you can swim. And on the way to the wadi, we actually stopped to get traditional Omani bread and karak tea. So karak tea is almost like a chai tea. It tastes very much like chai. But the Omani bread is essentially a really thin crepe, sandwiched with cheese and honey. And I mean, I could have eaten about 12 of those, in one sitting. But then one of the other things that we had when we were in Muscat, and then again, later in the trip, is actually one of the traditional dishes of Oman, which is called shua, which is similar to a barbecue concept where you pit roast something, but it's actually goat. But it's delicious. It's really, really good, served with rice. So that's kind of one of the more traditional dishes. But the interesting thing about Oman, since there's so many different cultures, you wind up with a lot of food that is Turkish or Middle Eastern. You know, there's so many different cultures, Indian, that you can find a lot of different foods there in a very, you know, very easily accessible. So no matter what you want to eat, you can find it.
Seafood?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. There's, as a matter of fact, in Muscat, there's a big fish market. And then in Salalah, which is also a different coast, but also, coastal, you can find a lot of really amazing seafood. Just not much wine.
Yeah, let's talk about that. That's kind of a bummer. So how far,
I mean, because you hear about Abu Dhabi and Dubai where, you know, this is basically luxury paradise. Mm-hmm. How far does the dollar go in Oman?
Well, it isn't a bargain country. Like it is a fairly, I don't want to say expensive country, but it's much more prices like what you would see in Europe or other parts of the world. So it's not, you don't go there necessarily to get a bargain. But what you go there for is a much more interesting cultural experience, and something really unique that not many people get to see. So I think that's a little bit of a culture shock for some people who just assume that certain countries are going to be much cheaper. But this is a very wealthy country and you're paying prices similar to what you would pay in Europe, just for a very different experience.
So back to the
whole. How are you getting from one place to the other? You talked about being in the desert and then being up in the mountains. Are you guys driving?
You can rent cars. I don't recommend it, except for just tooling around the city. So in the cities, you can take taxis. They're readily available and very easy to find. And you can even use taxis to do tours of the city. Like they'll take you around. But when it's going in between areas, we actually had drivers from, like, for example, a driver for the camp picked us up in Muscat and then drove us. That is highly recommended because most areas, both going into the Wadi Sands the Wahiba Sands, and then also going up to the resort in the mountains, you have to have a four-wheel drive. And you have to have the right tire pressure. You have to know how to drive on sand because, you know, there are certain points where you sort of turn left at the camel and there's not a road. So you're literally bouncing over dunes and you want someone who knows what they're doing.
So you need a wayfinder too. You need,
yeah, you need someone who knows where they're going. Otherwise and trust me, when you don't want to be stuck in the desert at night.
Or a rally car.
Yeah, there you go. Which would be fun.
So the car that you were in was just a standard. I mean, was it a Jeep or was it a?
It's a. So I think Toyota has a lock on the market. There's some really powerful Toyota four-wheel drive cars and trucks that are pretty standard. Like you see them everywhere, even, you know, similar paint jobs. And I will say after getting stuck in one and then also just a lot of different driving we did through the desert, including like driving up to the top of a dune so we could sandboard. That's like snowboarding, but you go down on sand. it's a you need the right vehicle. And we learned very quickly and through a lot of trial and error that the right tire pressure is around 12 psi as opposed to like 60 or whatever. Yes. You know. And you have to deflate your tires, and there's just a bunch of places where all they do is when you get out of the desert, they just reinflate your tires for you.
Wow.
Because otherwise you'll get stuck.
So how was sand surfing?
It was fun.
Did you succeed? Were you able to do it?
Yeah. I mean, to a certain amount. I actually had an injured foot when I went, so I had to be really careful. At first I wound up just sitting on the board and sliding down on my butt, which was actually a lot of fun. It was basically sledding. It was a lot of fun, but I just took another business trip not long ago, and I opened up my bag and half the Omani desert fell out of it. So I think I carried a little bit with me.
in all the places, I'm sure.
Exactly.
So then where did you go after the mountain resort? Did you?
Yeah. So the last stop on the trip was Salala, which is at the south of Oman, and that's a much more tropical area. You can get like coconuts and bananas on the side of the road, which are great for breakfast. And there's some really beautiful areas down in Salalo, including Almugsail Beach, which is a beach area that you can swim in, but then also just past it are these gorgeous cliffs that just drop off into the water. And there you're about 100 miles from the border to Yemen. So if you're really adventurous, you can take a day trip to the border to Yemen, and I suggest not cross.
But, just look at it.
And yeah.
Wait. Yeah.
Yeah.
So beaches there then? Were you like, actually on the beach?
Yeah, a couple of different beaches. I mean, the Wadi was the area where we spent most of the time swimming in the water. We walked in the water on the beach just because that's, you know, we didn't have time to do much more than that. We really wanted to see a few different areas. There are some really beautiful beaches there, and there's a lot of families that go and picnic and, you know, they'll spend their day there, obviously in a shady spot.
So you've been to a lot of beautiful beaches. Where would you rank these? Were these somewhere in the middle?
I'm guessing
Myrtle Beach does not make the list.
No.
Sorry, Sandy.
Although in all fairness, it's been more than probably two decades since I've been to Myrtle Beach.
It hasn't changed.
That's a shame. I wouldn't say it's the most beautiful beach. Like I think the most beautiful part of Oman, well, there are two parts, the desert. And again, we went specifically to the Wahiba Sands, which is a little bit easier to get to. There's also a part of the desert called the Empty Quarter, which is truly, it's foreboding, it's huge, et cetera. But the desert and then the mountains are sort of the favorites for me. And I would say the deserts, because you're very reflective there. When you're in a desert that size and that type of landscape, you have a lot of time to ponder life and think about your existence. And, you can see the Southern Cross, and you can see every constellation on Earth because it's so incredibly clear. But, so the desert's really beautiful and such a different landscape and an amazing place for reflection. And the mountains are just stunning. I mean, they're just these rolling green hills and really dramatic sort of rocks jutting out at them, but incredible hiking. So I think those are sort of my two favorites.
And these deserts are like what you see in the movies, like all sand.
Oh, yeah.
No cacti sticking up, no tumbleweeds, just sand.
With some camels wandering through. And I'm not kidding. Literally with some camels. Although I saw two scorpions.
Really?
Both just outside my tent. One was sizable. They were yellow scorpions as opposed to the black ones, which are slightly less poisonous than the black ones, but still not something you want to tangle with. And then a baby yellow scorpion, who was actually kind of cute, minus the fact that he was a scorpion. So both of them, I just let them on their merry way and zipped up my tent.
I wonder if scorpions have that same sort of maternal instinct where if you had touched the baby, you would have been...
I wasn't going to try it.
Yeah, that's wise.
Yeah.
You're a smart traveler.
Yeah.
There for
10 days.
Yeah, that's a nice long
trip. Yeah, it was a good trip.
So, okay, so we touched on this, but, you know, this is the Flyaway podcast, so we must talk about booze.
Yes.
Did you really just, you, there was no wine. You couldn't.
Well, no, I mean, so Oman is a dry country, so you're not going to find it in most restaurants, or you can't just go buy a bottle of wine. You have to have a special license to buy wine. But most of the international and larger hotels have bars and have wine and even full bars. So, at least, so three of the places we stayed had ability to get wine. I will say that you should probably think carefully when you're looking at getting, you know, going to a bar and getting a cocktail, what type of cocktail you want to get, because they're not necessarily as well versed in making everything possible. So one of my colleagues ordered a martini and they asked her if it was a single or a double. And despite her confusion, she asked for a single and she basically got a glass of vermouth. So,
tasty.
Yeah. So wine, you know, something simpler, gin and tonics or wine, you know, those are easier to get when you get to a place. But yeah, just don't expect most places to have alcohol and consider it a lovely cleansing opportunity.
Well, so the wines you did get, where did they generally come from? Were they African? Were they?
Actually, you get a lot of Turkish and Lebanese wines. There were some really good Lebanese wines that we wound up having on the trip. But yeah, for the most part, it's actually not. I think Lebanese was probably the most common that we wound up getting on the trip. And I was really quite surprised. I didn't know that much about Lebanese wines, but luckily one of my travel companions did.
So I have a question. I had a friend who was going to Dubai and I was doing some research for her and found out that they have pink taxis in Dubai that are driven by women that are supposed to be only for women to get in. So is it like that there too? Do they have those restrictions?
No, the Sultan has been pretty vocal about, increasing the rights for women, et cetera. So it's actually an extremely safe country and you're going to get into a taxi. You don't have to get into a female driven taxi or anything like that. Almost all of our taxi drivers were male and almost all of them too they'll have cards where if you want to have the same taxi driver and you can call him and he'll come get you at your hotel and take you if you get someone that you really like. So you don't really have any of those issues. You will see local women in traditional dress. So there's definitely still a difference there, but you don't have to worry about can you drive or do you need to only get into a certain type of taxi.
So I have a question for you. I know I've been a couple places in the world where it's better if people assume you're Canadian. Or anything else?
Yeah.
Other than American, did you feel that way at all? Was there any?
You know, I didn't necessarily feel that way. I felt pretty comfortable telling people where I was from. I also sort of feel like sometimes I'm always a little careful about making sure I tell the truth about where I'm from, because you don't want to be in a situation where someone thinks you're hiding something. But it's an extremely safe country. So I didn't feel strange about saying that. I've also been in countries where it's not a great idea to say you're American, either as a woman or just as an American. But in this case, I didn't feel any concern about that at all. And most of the time you know, they're like, oh, where from in America? And you say New York, and they're like really excited because they have a cousin or a friend or somebody who lives in New York and they want to ask if you know them.
Because you clearly live right next door.
There's 9 million people in New York. I didn't feel that way at all. It's actually a very welcoming culture, and welcoming place to go. And again, an extremely safe country.
With the attempt to draw in other industries and things, were you running into a lot of expats? Were you running into people who were living in Oman?
Interestingly enough, a lot of the tour guides and everything that you can find, like local guides, are actually from other countries and have lived there for a really long time. One of the most well-known tour guides in Salalah is actually a German woman. So you tend to find a lot of different cultures who have come and settled in because they've just fallen in love with the country, and seen an opportunity, to build a business. But, most of the expats that you'll see in Oman are actually working in the oil industry, and they're working alongside the Omani. So, so you don't tend to run into as many of them on the street necessarily.
So they're sticking with the industries that,
yeah,
that they know. They're not trying, yeah, to necessarily attract new industry or anything, yeah, like that.
Although the Sultan is, there's a lot of discussion about the Sultan when you're in Sultan Qaboos, when you're in, Oman, he's very, very well loved. And again, he's been in power there for a very long time. And, you'll hear a lot of conversations about how he talks about, you know, needing to prepare for the future. So, you know, oil is oil, but now, but won't always be. And so there needs to be other, educational opportunities and industries. And he's pushing pretty hard on education.
Great.
Very forward thinking.
Very forward thinking, absolutely.
So since the country's been so old, what kind of architectural gems and all in historical places can you see?
Well, and I mean, the mosques are fairly representative. The interesting thing, if you've ever been to someplace like Dubai, where you're used to these soaring skyscrapers and towering buildings, Oman doesn't really have that. And for a long time, you weren't allowed to build anything higher than 7 stories. I think they've relaxed that a little bit, but it's all about humble and it's all about being welcoming. So most of the architecture you see is much more, you know, integrated into the landscape, and the palaces, the mosques, and then there's several old forts that are incredibly old and still standing and have been really well preserved are still intact, and you can tour a lot of those. You can't tour the palace, but you can tour the forts, etc. And so those have been really well preserved, but it feels much more traditional than a lot of cities like Dubai, for example, where everything's just higher, bigger, newer.
So how did you get there from JFK? Do you have a direct flight?
No.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so.
No. We flew through Istanbul, actually, and did a changeover in Istanbul. So flew through Istanbul and then went straight on to Muscat from there, which took, I think, 16 hours total to get there. Then on the way back, it was a little bit longer because we actually flew from Salalah to Muscat, Muscat to Istanbul, and then Istanbul back to JFK. Although still, I think one of the hardest parts of the trip was getting to JFK. So it was just from my house. But it was quite a traffic jam. But yeah, so the flights in general were really, they're long, but they weren't that bad. And that was all through Turkish Airlines. So it was pretty seamless, but there are several different airline options you could take to get there, and you could have taken different routes, but we just found, I mean, it was actually a pretty good deal. I think it was like $750 for the entire round trip airfare.
That's a nice.
Yeah.
And Turkish Air was nice.
Yeah. It's leg room isn't the best, but you know, I'm tall, so.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, a lot of American airlines are the same.
But the food is amazing, and their lounge in Istanbul is insane. It's so good. They have a great tea and an olive bar, and you don't have to have status to get into it, so it's really, it's quite nice.
Nice.
Yeah.
Excellent. All right. Well, do you guys have any other questions? We're right about time, so I will wrap it up unless you are dying to ask something else.
No, I think this was really cool, though. It's totally different perspective from what we usually do. Thank you.
I always love when she tells me where she's going on vacation. I'm like, oh, Oman. Okay. I guess I'll check that out. I never thought so.
I have one quick question for her about like handcraft goods and artisans. Mm-hmm. Did you see a lot of that there? And where?
Yeah. So each city has a souk, you know, sort of an outdoor market, and the markets are divided a bit into the different types, you know, so there'll be textiles in one place, et cetera. You do find a little bit of stuff that's, you can tell it's a bit more mass produced or something that's, not really authentic, but it's not that difficult to spot the things that are much more traditional. And most of the time when you have a good guide, they're going to help you find those best spots. So, definitely be a little bit discerning, but you can find some just stunning stuff. So they have some really beautiful baskets, some of which are just plain baskets, but others have camel hair on them or some sort of leather on them that are really quite gorgeous. The jewelry is also amazing. And then there's a lot of sort of, you know, tableware and stuff that you can get, of course, along with textiles. So it's really, really beautiful stuff. But the most popular thing that people tend to buy there is frankincense. I know most people are not terribly familiar, but frankincense is a tree, and they always pair. There's a male and female tree that are always next to each other, and they have slightly different colors of sap, and the sap dries and becomes frankincense, which is basically, you know, you can burn it as an incense or something like that, but it's a very treasured, treasured tree in Oman. And so frankincense tends to be the most typical thing that people leave with. It has a bit of an evergreen smell to it.
So did you bring home a treasure of some sort?
I actually brought home a necklace that, has in Arabic writing, the word life, in gold. So it's, I like to collect jewelry when I travel because it's something that I can wear that I can carry with me. And frankly, it doesn't take much space
small.
To store it. So I did, I really wanted to buy, there was this gorgeous wood salad bowl with silver handles, but, I wasn't quite. I didn't want to carry it on the rest of the trip. So.
Yeah. There's the carrying it and then the storing it when you get home.
It's
like, oh, that's great. Where am I going to put it?
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. Well, that is our show for this week. We welcome your comments and feedback on this episode or any episode, really. To leave comments, visit us at outlandertravel.com. Then click podcast at the top of the page and find the episode you wish to comment on. Or you can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/outlanderpodcast. And please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes. On behalf of Lindsay, Donna, Sandy, Laura, and myself, Elizabeth, we extend a very special thank you to Linda for joining us once again. Hey. And of course, thank you all for joining us here at Outlander Travel. We will see you next week. Gotta fly.